I don't mean that you smile at superiors and tell the superior, or at least in your mind, she doesn't know that I've got a conscience of my own, because part of my conscience is that unless the superior commands me to do evil, I am to obey. One of the rules of superiors, let's not forget, is to enlighten the conscience. This is just a footnote to being a superior. Now, number six in this means of how do I know whether I, or how can I tell whether others are growing in holiness? Number six is readiness to help others. In other words, whatever else holiness is, it is not selfishness. The closer we draw to God, the more generous we become with others. That should be patent. And the generosity toward others is a good index of my nearness to God. And here again, I must be prudent. For example, when I came back to New York, I was told by my superiors that they had just removed my second telephone. I was happy they did. It protected the switchboard for handling private calls, but also, now that the telephone is removed, it protects me in my readiness to help others. I was given a short lecture in no uncertain terms about this readiness to help others and the expense of what they think is my health, that I'm still worth keeping around. So prudence is assumed. And remember, readiness to help does not always mean that I'm able to help. Do you follow that? In so many ways, maybe in most cases, what people most want from us is to know that we love them, that we care, that we're ready to help. Don't you think so? I wish I could, but lack of time, lack of energy, lack of whatever. And always remember, we can help others with our prayers. Now, norm number seven. One way that I can manifest my growth in holiness is by my willingness to be unknown. In other words, as a person becomes more holy, they also become more ready and willing to be obscure. The surest sign of unholiness is the desire to be seen, to be praised, to be recognized. That doesn't mean that everybody who hides what they're doing is necessarily holy. But the desire not to be known is a good index of how close I am to God. I could not think of a more valuable examination of conscience than to examine myself on ways, for example, on a given day or half day, that I have done things and allowed my left hand to know what my right hand is doing. Now, number eight in our list of norms. Every one of these, I've got 22 norms. The only reason I stopped at 22 is I ran out of paper. Each one of these, honest, deserves at least 1 hour. Number eight, desire for the cross. Now, the saints warn us, for example, Robert Bellarmine, not to ask God for suffering. It's enough to ask God for the grace to accept the cross that he sends me. So the desire for the cross does not really mean that I'm asking for more suffering. The language, properly interpreted, means I desire to be resigned to whatever cross God sends me. It doesn't mean that I'm looking for more suffering. What I'm looking for is more strength to carry whatever cross the Lord may send me. Or negatively, it means, and The Imitation of Christ is the classic book here, it means a desire for the cross, that I do not run away from the cross. In how many ways, every day, certain things that we avoid because they're inconvenient or unpleasant or less tasteful, or there's less pleasure I get out of it. I think I've mentioned this at least once. In the novitiate, there were 6 of us at table. I never saw 7 pieces of fruit on the table, always just 6. And the pieces of fruit were never the same in size. And there would be, for example, apples and oranges. It took months to resign ourselves to say, well, taking the things that we liked the least. It might turn out that what we left for the last person was what he liked the least. All right, that's his cross. But life is filled with opportunities for giving up what we like and in doing what we dislike. And we do not run away from the cross. Number 9. A good norm for recognizing our growth in holiness is peace of soul. Notice number 8 and number 9 are totally compatible. A peaceful soul is not a soul without a cross. A peaceful soul is not in conflict. Peace means negatively the absence of conflict. What kind of conflict between my will and the will of God? The experience of the absence of that conflict is the church's definition for interior peace. Number 10, the amount of formal prayer. Now, that doesn't mean that a person, say, who prays 90 minutes a day is twice as holy as someone who prays 45 minutes a day. No. But again, all things being equal, holiness does inspire a person to pray more. It is a good habit to count the number of minutes that I spend each day in formal prayer. I've been doing this for so many years, I've stopped counting. And even the kind of prayer, whether it's vocal prayer or mental prayer, or say prayer before the Blessed Sacrament, all I know is that all of us, by and large, are more busy than perhaps we want to admit. And our being busy can interfere with the most important task in life, which is to pray. So, for example, as a person goes on through religious life, 5, 10 or more years, and prays less, there is something happening to the spiritual life. Number 11. Abnegation of one's own will. The abnegation, or the denial of one's own will, of course, comes from within the person himself. the practice of self-denial is a very good index of how close that person is to God. Because the more closely God is united with the soul, the more he will inspire that person to surrender his or her will. And remember, the abnegation is not only or mainly in matters of food or bodily mortification. It must be 25 years ago, I read an article by a former Jesuit who became a Trappist. I happen to know him. He left the Jesuits, and he thought he would enter a more austere life by becoming a Trappist. And he said, "I found the Trappist way of life easier than my life as a Jesuit." And the reason he gave is, "I found that mortifying my body and tightening my belt, in time I got used to it. But I never got used to taking orders." So this abnegation of one's own will, for example, I'm a mortifying type, and my superior tells me, "You may not fast," and I smile and start enjoying my food. This is a sign of growth in holiness, whereas continually mortifying myself, independent of obedience, could even be sinful. Number 12 in our list of norms, discretion in speech. Oh, how I like to say this. Holiness is silent. That doesn't mean that holy people never talk. By now, I would have despaired of my salvation. But you know the difference between talking and speaking. Speech should always be purposeful. It should always be charitable. It should always be prudent. It should always be humble. The four qualities of speech. When we just talk, we fail in one, or some people manage to fail in all four of those norms of good speech. Discretion. This discretion also involves knowing whom I say what to. There is great wisdom in being able to distinguish between how much and what I tell whom. And as a priest, I can say this, it is a special gift of God, which we were promised during our studies and before ordination, as one of the graces of the Sacrament of Orders, that we would receive, provided we were faithful to the grace, extraordinary discretion in speech. And this speaking to people that have charge of others, discretion of speech is, I would say, of the essence of being a successful and effective director of souls. That you not only know what to tell whom and when, you find out what state of mind or in what state of feelings the person is in before you start talking. But also, I am very discreet in what I tell others because my previous informants may consider that I am making a disclosure of a confidence they shared with me. Rather fail in saying less than in saying one word too much in talking about other people to whomever you are speaking. Number 13, restraint of the tongue. Well, isn't that the same thing? No, discretion in speech has to do with the mind. That's the virtue of prudence. Restraint of the tongue is the virtue of temperance, in using my will in controlling the natural pleasure that most human beings get out of just talking. Now, there are times when this is one reason for recreation, say in a community. Now we can relax and talk and not, be, as you might say, restrained in what we are saying. But there, too, charity comes into play. But it is especially during the day for religious. That's why, over the centuries, the Society of Jesus has had the rule, until we take our final vows, already a priest, never to talk outside of recreation in the vernacular tongue, but to use Latin. I think I told you on some other occasion the spiritual somersault I had to turn to keep that rule. But I was stubborn enough to want to keep the rule. But during the day, Ignatius tells us, and if I pass it on to you, speak only when necessity or charity requires. To keep that rule is to practice great wisdom. Number 14 in our list of norms, bodily mortification. That doesn't mean, as we've been saying all along, that just because a person is bodily mortified, that person is necessarily holy. Not because I'm eating less this year than I did last year. That doesn't mean I am more holy. Maybe I am, but it doesn't necessarily follow. However, an unmortified body can hardly enshrine a holy soul. In this life, a soul that wants to serve God mortifies the body because it knows what a threat to sanctity an uncontrolled body can be. An uncontrolled body will keep me from prayer. I start sleeping. An uncontrolled body will keep me from wanting to exert myself to practice charity. I have to move my muscles. An uncontrolled body is going to make it hard for me to keep chaste. I won't control my eyes and ears and touch. So bodily mortification is of the essence of progress in holiness. I would add, before we go on, because we have many more things to cover, but we're stuck with the 22 that I've got here, but I think it's worth going over. It touches on so many aspects. I would say that bodily mortification should be practiced according to one's spiritual needs. The body should be mortified according to the needs of the soul. I recognize that I'm lazy. Very well. I've got to mortify my body in working harder. Every religious should carry an avis sign, except it should be a different subject. Not we, but I try harder. That's a good description of the religious life. We religious are to try harder than we would have had we not become religious. Try harder to do what? To overcome our fallen human nature and therefore mortify our body in order to cope with my distinctive failings. Some people, and many religious, can never watch a secular movie. Never. Never. Otherwise, their chastity is in danger and will be lost. Some people cannot, I mark my words, cannot read a secular paper. Cannot. And they've got to practice bodily mortification to retain whatever virtue is in danger by reading secular news. These are good to hear. Some people can never touch anything alcoholic. Never. Never. Even a little. Some people can never take, you might say, an easy or comfortable posture when they pray. They start sleeping immediately. So they must at least, say, walk around. I think I told you about one of our fellow novices, Delmar Dosh. He had the unbelievable ability, we envied him, of standing up straight as a spindle and fast asleep. None of us could do that. So we'll find out, what is my need? The purpose of mortifying the body is to sanctify the soul. But then, John of the Cross, of all people, should say that when you pray, mortify your body only as much as you need to in order to pray. You can pray better, this is John of the Cross, if you can pray better sitting down, sit down. Thanks, John. The purpose of prayer is to pray. Number 15, a sign of growth in holiness is avoiding praise. And I mean avoiding praise. That doesn't mean that I don't do praiseworthy things. That would be cheating. I won't practice a certain virtue because I don't want to be praised. My friends, you get the extra grace you need to stand human praise when you practice that virtue. You follow the logic? So avoiding praise does not mean it's better to be sinful. To avoid praise in order to avoid praise. Christ himself tells us, doesn't he, to make sure that people will see what we are doing so they can glorify not us, but our Heavenly Father. And just for the record, do you know what glorify means? To give glory? It means recognizing excellence with praise. So we should perform good works. But avoiding praise essentially means I do nothing in order to be praised by human beings. Avoiding praise should read avoiding human praise. I never seek it. I never do things in order to be praised by human beings. It also means that, if possible, whatever good I do, I try to hide it. Many times I can't. When I can, I should, especially when I fear legitimately that people are going to praise me. And watch this, are going to praise me, and I won't have the humility to take the praise. One reason, after so many years in dealing with souls, one reason that God does not allow often gifted people to do the good work they are capable of doing is because they lack the humility. They cannot take the inevitable praise that always follows on doing good. I'm not sure this is the hardest thing in the spiritual life, but I know of none other. To be able to take praise and to remain humble. In dealing with others, in caring for souls, forming them, ask the Lord to enlighten you on how much praise each person you deal with can take. Some need more. Some need less. Too much praise to the wrong person can be disastrous. Not enough recognition for other persons can be frustrating. I do not seek the praise. Avoiding praise also implies that I welcome dispraise. I welcome discredit. I welcome non-recognition. I welcome, as hard as the word may sound, I welcome dishonor. This concludes this lecture on how can we recognize growth in holiness.